Hello. Today's scripture reading is Ecclesiastes 1, verses 1 through 3 and 8 through 11. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations. Even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. This is the word of the Lord.
Same old song, just a drop of water.
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means?
Carpe diem. That's seize the day.
Very good. Mr.
Meeks.
Meeks. Another unusual name. Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No. Ding! Thanks for playing anyway. Because we are food for worms, lads. Because believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die. I'd like you to step forward over here and peruse some of the faces from the past. You've walked past them many times, but I don't think you've really looked at them. They're not that different from you, are they?
Same haircuts, full of hormones, just like you. Invincible, just like you feel. The world is their oyster. They believe they're destined for great things, just like many of you. Their eyes are full of hope, just like you. Did they wait until it was too late to make from their lives even one iota of what they were capable? Because you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilizing daffodils. If you listen real close, you can hear them whisper their legacy to you. Go on, lean in. Listen. You hear it?
What's the movie? The Poet Society. Going back to 1989 for that one. That's one of my favorite films, and that's one of my favorite scenes in Dead Poet Society. In case you're not familiar with the premise, Robin Williams plays an English professor at an all-boys boarding school, and he is trying to get these adolescent boys to think about something that teenagers don't like to think about, and that is the fact that their lives are brief and fleeting, and will one day come to an end. He takes them to these black and white photographs in the hallway that they pass by every day, probably similar to photos that you've seen somewhere, of people who are long since dead and buried. But he wants them to see that these guys in the photographs, when the pictures were taken, were at the exact same age as these boys are now who are looking at them. And they weren't thinking that one day their lives would end. They weren't thinking that one day, by a future generation, they would be seen as a relic of a bygone era. They were simply living life. And Robin Williams' character, the professor, wants to get the boys to stop thinking about the weekend and girls and football just long enough to realize that one day they're going to be the ones in the old photographs, long since dead and buried, considered a thing of the past by a future generation. He wants them to ask a question that we all have to ask at some point in our lives. Because if we don't ask it and we don't think about it, one day we, like them, will find ourselves on our deathbed mourning that life has passed us by. And the question is this: if life is that way, if it is so brief and fleeting, if I'm going to end up in the ground sooner or later, then what's the point? What's it all about? Where is the meaning in life? That professor, Robin Williams' character, was certainly not the first teacher to try to get students to wrestle with this question. An ancient teacher in Israel labored to get young people to ask the same question, and his words, 3,000 years later, still haunt anyone who takes the time to read them. His words are recorded in the book of Ecclesiastes. We've been in a sermon series this last few weeks called Fruit Salad, Wisdom for Life. We've been looking at the wisdom books in the Bible to see how we can learn to make good decisions. Wisdom, how to make good decisions in the realities of life. We spent a few weeks in Proverbs, which basically operates on the premise that if you live according to wise principles, your life will generally go well. But last week we looked at Job, which acknowledges that sometimes, even if you do everything right, you might suffer tremendously. And today we're looking at this book of Ecclesiastes, which wrestles with the question that is another wisdom question, a question that every person alive must face at some time. Is there a way to find meaning in this life? Now, we're going to survey through the whole book in a brief way, so I've put most of the verses on the screen today, but in case you'd like to have a Bible open and follow along, Ecclesiastes chapter 1 is where we'll start, and in the Pew Bible, that's on page 1035. If you've ever read the book of Ecclesiastes before, you know that on the surface it can be about as uplifting as a colonoscopy. It's perplexing. It doesn't make you feel good most of the time. But if you take the time to understand it, Ecclesiastes really says something profound and something hopeful. It was a book that was compiled in ancient Israel by an editor. The editor makes a few remarks in the beginning and a few remarks in the end, but by and large, he's put together the teachings of a man called Koheleth. Koheleth, it's a Hebrew word that means assembler or teacher or perhaps professor. Now, we're not quite sure exactly who Koheleth was. Some think it was King Solomon. Either way, we do know that it was an older, wise, wealthy king who had many wives. So the editor puts together this book of Koheleth's teachings for an audience of young people, a class of graduate students, if you will, seeking to prod them to wrestle with an important question about life. Now, for us to understand Ecclesiastes, there are a couple of very important terms that we have to understand first. And one of those we heard just a moment ago when Kristen read a few verses. You heard the way the book begins in chapter 1. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That's a happy way to start, isn't it? That word meaningless is a Hebrew word, hebel. It could be translated meaningless, but it's probably better to translate it as vapor or breath. And a few times in the book, the translators keep that, vapor or breath. The teacher is saying that everything in life is just like a vapor. It's there one minute and gone the next. One way that you might get your head around this is to think about a very cold morning. We haven't had too many of those yet, thankfully, but we've had a couple mornings in the 30s. You go out to your car on the way to school or work, and you breathe, and you can see your breath in the air. For a moment, it hangs there, thick like smoke. But then, within a second or two, it's gone, just like that. Vapor. And the teacher is saying, everything in life is that way. It's here one moment, it's gone the next. Some of you probably feel that way about your lives. You think, where has the time gone? In fact, some of you who have grown children like to remind those of us who have small children that life passes too quickly. Sometimes you'll say things like, oh, enjoy these days, they don't last long. You're welcome to come relive them at my house in the middle of the night when my kids are throwing up this winter. Now, I know that there's truth to what you're saying, but sometimes it doesn't feel that way, right? But the people that we love, it feels that way. They're here one moment, they're gone the next. The things that we spend our energy to accomplish, they satisfy us just as much as vapor. We get to the end of our lives and it's passed us by. It's just like breath. What happened to it? To bring this into our day, it might help us to think for a moment about the people, the 130 people who died in Paris last week in those attacks. Most of them are young, they're out at a concert hall, they're eating and drinking and dancing, listening to music, enjoying life, and then boom, just like that, it's over. No warning. None of them had a chance to prepare for it. Vapor. Meaningless. If life is that way, then what do we do with it? There's another term that's very important to us to understand if we're going to get Ecclesiastes in addition to meaningless or vapor. It's this phrase, under the sun. Under the sun. It shows up 30 times in this book of 12 chapters. Here's one example from chapter 2. He says, "So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." A lot of people have tried to make sense of Ecclesiastes in various ways, but I think this phrase is what unlocks it. See, when he's talking about life under the sun, he's talking about living life without regard to anything that's above, without regard to God, without regard to eternity, as if this life today is all we have, as if we're here by accident. There was no reason for us to be here, as if there's nothing after this life. We simply become food for worms. This is all there is. He's saying, what happens when you look at life that way, under the sun, without regard for God? Is it possible to find meaning that way? This is what he's trying to get people to wrestle with. Now, if we understand these important phrases, then what we realize next is that the bulk of the book is made up of the three pursuits that the teacher tried to find meaning in that kind of world, to find a source of satisfaction. So we're going to look at those, these three things. And what's interesting to me is that this could easily be talking about our lives today. This doesn't seem ancient at all. If you were here last week, you know Pastor Kevin was our guest speaker, and he said something very intriguing. He said that learning from your own mistakes is smart. Learning from others' mistakes is wise, and not learning from either is foolish. So today we're going to try to learn from Koheleth's mistakes. Where did he look for meaning? We see the first pursuit in chapter 1, verse 13. "I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Verse 17. "Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief." First thing he does to try to find the meaning of life is go off to college. Open the books, become a serious student, look into philosophy, find the answers to all the tough questions. Surely that'll give him the meaning of life, right? Well, comes up empty because, like many of you, he goes off, he reads, he debates, and he finds that the more he learns, the more questions he has. So what does he say about this in chapter 2? He says, "Yet I saw that wise and foolish people share the same fate. Both of them die. Just as the fool will die, so will I. So of what value is all my wisdom? Then I said to myself, this is all so meaningless. The life of the wise man ends at the same place as the fool. It's all vapor." He's saying, here's where knowledge and philosophy will get you. If you want to find the meaning of life in books, guess where it takes you? You learn we all die. We all end up in the same place. It doesn't matter if you're wise or a fool. You're going to be worm food. Or what does Robin Williams say? Fertilizing daffodils. That's your future. And if that's true, then what you do during your time on earth doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're a good person or a bad person, if you're a philanthropist or a parasite on society, you're all going to end up in the same place. It's not very satisfying, is it? So what does he try next? Ecclesiastes 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, let's give pleasure a try. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. It is silly to be laughing all the time, I said. What good does it do to seek only pleasure? After much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine. In this way, I hope to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world. So he goes off to college. He's a good boy, a good student. That doesn't satisfy him, so he starts to party. Live it up. That's where the good things are, right? Well, where does that take him? Now, let's be honest. Many of us have probably tried that, so we can't exactly cast stones of judgment, right? But I want you to think for a moment. If you pursue this pleasure, a life of pleasure, as your source of satisfaction, your meaning, what's the end game? Well, we've seen some pretty vivid examples in the news lately. A few weeks ago, we saw Lamar Odom, NBA player, former NBA player, who ends up in a coma on the floor of a brothel in Nevada after a weekend-long sex and drug binge. Just this week, we see Charlie Sheen in the news, successful actor who's acknowledging that he's HIV positive as a result of a life of sex and drugs. He was known to spend $30,000 per night on prostitutes and cocaine. Now, why am I mentioning them? Not as a means of judgment. No, not at all. I want you to see that if you make pleasure your pursuit, where it takes you. You see, what will happen is you'll feel it. It'll feel good for a moment. But like Ecclesiastes says, it's like chasing the wind. You can't grasp it. And so you have to increase the levels of pleasure, the thrill, more and more and more to be able to enjoy it and have that fleeting moment of satisfaction. And where that takes you is self-destruction. Doesn't work. And that's why the teacher in Ecclesiastes makes this conclusion that looking for meaning and pleasure is like trying to grasp the wind. All right, so what else? Let's try something else. Third pursuit, chapter 2, verse 4. He says, I also tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, filling them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate my many flourishing groves. I also owned great herds and flocks more than any of the kings who lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, the treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers, both men and women, and had many beautiful concubines. I had everything a man could desire. Of course, it didn't come for free. He had to work. So he says, I even found great pleasure in hard work, an additional reward for all my labors. So the party life isn't cutting it, and now it's time to get serious. See, I told you this would sound like Long Island, right? Party hard and then work hard. Play and then spend lots of hours working so you can pay for the play. Well, it's time to make some money. Surely this will satisfy him, right? If he can have everything that he desires. Well, where does that leave him? Chapter 2, verse 11. But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless. It was like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. And then he adds something that's kind of humorous in chapter 5. He says, those who love money will never have enough. How absurd to think that wealth brings true happiness. And here it is. The more you have, the more people come to help you spend it. He's a realist. So what is the advantage of wealth, except perhaps to watch it run through your fingers? People who work hard sleep well, whether they eat little or much. But the rich are always worrying and seldom get a good night's sleep. Didn't satisfy. A guy named Patrick Morley wrote a book called Man in the Mirror. It's written for men. And he has something pretty accurate, I think, to say about the way that we pursue things. He says, today men are consumed by desires to buy things they don't need with money they don't have to impress people they don't like. Does that sound like anybody you know? Jim Carrey, another actor, said something that's very poignant. He said, I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see it's not the answer. That's what the professor was saying 3,000 years ago in Ecclesiastes. I've had it all. Everything a man could want. Education, a good job, insane amounts of wealth, vacation homes, power, beautiful women. And yet, it's all a vapor. Why? Why doesn't it satisfy? Well, it's hard to enjoy any of that knowing that at any moment you might die. And you can't take it with you. It can all seem quite pointless. Are you depressed yet? Well, along the way, in all of his pursuits of meaning, the teacher makes a fascinating observation in chapter 3, verse 11. He says, God has made everything beautiful for its own time. He has planted eternity in the human heart. He's planted eternity in our hearts. God has planted a longing in our hearts that can't be satisfied by anything in this world. You may have heard what C.S. Lewis said about this observation one time. He said, the fact that nothing in this world satisfies our longing says that we were made for another world. None of these other pursuits will satisfy our hearts because our hearts were made for something else, something greater. I wonder if any of you can identify with what the teacher is saying here. You've been there. You've gotten a good education. You've had a great job. You've made some decent money. You've had a good family. You've had beautiful romantic partners, and yet you feel empty. Like you too, the great song, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. You still feel like the best thing in life is the next thing, like Tom Brady. The best Super Bowl ring is the next Super Bowl ring. Never satisfied. If that's the case, Ecclesiastes tells us why you feel that way. He's saying that if you live life under the sun, if you live as if this is all there is, there's no God and there's no eternity, life will be meaningless. There is no way around it. If you live without regard for God and without regard for eternity, you will have no lasting source of satisfaction. Now, to be fair, there are some atheists nowadays who would argue with that and say that's not true. They would say, life is what you make of it. You don't need God and you don't need heaven to make something meaningful out of your life because you construct your own meaning. You insert meaning into whatever you decide to. And that sounds pretty good, constructing your own meaning. But isn't that what the teacher tried to do in Ecclesiastes with these three things? He tried to construct meaning in them and they failed him. Take an example, a very good thing, family. It sounds very noble to say that my meaning in life is my family. I've devoted myself to them. I've sacrificed myself for my kids. Sounds great. Family's a good thing. What happens when your kids are in the concert hall in Paris and the shots ring out like that? And your meaning is gone. I don't mean to be morbid, but we all need to wrestle with this question. Have we placed our meaning in something that can be taken away? Now, there's a positive implication, of course. The other side of this coin is that if you're going to find meaning in life, it must come from some reality outside of yourself and some reality that's greater than this world or this life. So how does the teacher leave us? Does he leave us hanging without hope? Of course not. If we could boil down the book of Ecclesiastes, the teacher basically says, there are three ways that I've found meaning in life. The first two are pretty important, but the third is the key that unlocks all of it. Here's the first way that he found meaning that I think we should understand as well. By cultivating qualitative relationships. Cultivating relationships. Listen to what he says in chapter 4, verse 9. You've probably heard this at a wedding, although it wasn't originally about marriage. He says, two people can accomplish more than twice as much as one. They get a better return for their labor. If one person falls, the other can reach out and help. But people who are alone when they fall are in real trouble. And on a cold night, two under the same blanket can gain warmth from each other. But how can one be warm alone? A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer. Three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. He's saying that one of the greatest sources of satisfaction that God has given you in this life is in authentic relationships, where you are known, where it's safe to be you, and honest, sharing life with people. That's why we put so much emphasis on small groups here. Such a key part of life. You should invest in your relationships with people with all the energy and more that you invest in all of life's other pursuits. But there's a second way that the teacher says to find meaning in life. And if we get this, wow, this would change the way we live. He says, learn to be content. Learn to be happy with what you have and not think about what you don't have. Listen to the way that he says this. Chapter 6, verse 9. Enjoy what you have rather than desiring what you don't have. Just dreaming about nice things is meaningless. It's like chasing the wind. He also says it in another way in chapter 7. Don't long for the good old days, for you don't know whether they were any better than today. In other words, some of us tend to look into the future and always want what's still ahead, while others of us are always looking backward because we think the good old days were really the life. And if either of those is the case, we're not really living right now. One other thing he says about this, chapter 5, even so, I've noticed one thing at least that is good. It is good for people to eat well, drink a good glass of wine, and enjoy their work, whatever they do under the sun, for however long God lets them live. You see, because you realize the brevity of life, enjoy what God has given you today. I think if we're honest, we as Americans have a really hard time with this, and I include myself in that. It is so hard to be happy with the thing that we have because it wears off so quickly. Take a new car. You save up, you get the new car you've always wanted. Oh boy, is it fun to sit in, has that new car smell, it's really shiny. How long does it take for that to wear off? A few months, maybe a year? You start looking for another one, or insert, fill in the blank, a car, boat, iPhone, house, husband, I don't know. The novelty wears off and you want a new one. Why is that the case? Well, there's one reason that Patrick Morley helps us understand. It's called psychological obsolescence. Psychological obsolescence. Now, that's a big phrase, so let me break it down for you. That means that marketing strategists have teamed up with psychologists and they figured out how to convince us that what we have is obsolete and therefore we need the newest thing. Your iPhone 6 is not good enough anymore because there's something newer and you need it or you're out of date. See? Now, there's history behind this. After World War II, the manufacturers were pumping out far more goods than Americans could buy. And so they had to figure out a way to convince us that we needed what we didn't have. And you know what? We bought into it. Where has that left us? Many of us in a world of debt, with a lot of anxiety, working long hours to pay the loan so that we can't enjoy what we have right now, including relationships. Learn to be content. When Kim and I got married in Baltimore, it didn't look like my grandfather was going to get to come up from Tennessee for the wedding because my grandmother was pretty much on her deathbed. She was at the end stages of Alzheimer's. And when he thought he wasn't going to get to come, he decided he would send us a long letter with all of his advice for our marriage. Now, he was very generous with advice. And so he sat down with a yellow legal pad and he wrote page after page telling about his courtship before the war, his wedding after the war, the marriage that would last 59 years. But in those pages, he said something that has stuck in my mind and I think will probably never leave. Words were so poignant, we read them at our rehearsal dinner from the yellow legal paper. He said, "Everyone lives as if the golden years are off in the future, but the golden years are now." Do you see what he was saying? If you always live as if the best years of your life are somewhere in the future, they always will be. You will never get there. And because of that, live right now, whatever your circumstances, whatever your life stage, as if these are the best days of your life. We've kind of made that a motto for our family. Now, that can be hard to do if you have a newborn waking you up in the middle of the night, multiple times a night. If you have a teenager keeping you up all night with worry or some other life circumstance, that could be really hard to do. Golden years are now. Learn to be content. That's what the teacher was saying 3,000 years ago. Of course, the Apostle Paul tells us much later the secret to being content. one of the most famous verses in the Bible, Philippians 4. He says, I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through Christ who gives me strength. And that brings us to the last answer, the biggest answer, the key that makes the other two things possible. We see it at the very end of Ecclesiastes, after all the teachers of observations, chapter 12, verse 13. Here is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey His commands, for this is the duty of every person. If living as if this life is everything leaves you empty, life under the sun leaves you without meaning. If you need a source of meaning outside of yourself and outside of this reality, here's the answer, he says. Fear the Lord. Now, does that sound familiar? If you've been here while we looked at Proverbs, it should. Remember Proverbs chapter 1? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, remember how we define this. This is not fear. This is not being afraid that God's out to harm you. That's not what this is about. Remember, we define this as a joyful fear, a reverence for God that's born out of love, out of the recognition of how good and kind He is to you, that He's not out to harm you. You see, when you begin to fear the Lord in this way, to live as if God is the author and center of everything with a desire to please Him, I want you to notice what it does to your life, how it changes things. The teacher hinted at this back in chapter 2. He said, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God, but here it is. For without Him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases Him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, He gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. Do you see how things change here? When you live out of the joyful fear of the Lord, seeking to please Him with Him at the center, suddenly all the things that were meaningless before, that were just a chasing after the wind, they've become gifts that you can enjoy. Without God, they're just emptiness. They leave you coming up short, but with Him, you can enjoy your work and your food and your family and your friendships. Now, understand how this works. This is not about trying to obey God to make Him give you things. This is seeking to please God because in pleasing Him, you find your greatest pleasure. I love the way that Tim Keller says this. He says, you know you love someone when your happiness is found in their happiness. Your greatest happiness is to see them happy. Parents, you know this. Nothing makes you happier than seeing your child laugh with delight. You'll do anything to get that. Here's what it all boils down to. Life has meaning when you seek to please God, because in pleasing Him, you find your greatest pleasure. I'm going to say that again. Life has meaning when you live to please God, because in pleasing Him, you find your greatest pleasure. You see, when your life is oriented around that, that's when you can sit down and enjoy your simple dinner on an ordinary November evening with your family or friends, because it's all a gift. That's when you can look forward to going to work and working hard, because in working hard, you are pleasing God, and in pleasing Him, you find delight. But how do we get to that place? How do our hearts get oriented around that pursuit? Comes by, once again, as with all the wisdom books, putting Ecclesiastes into the big story of the Bible. The big story of what God has done because He delights in you. And at the center of that story, we see Jesus Christ, the Son of God, hanging on a Roman instrument of execution, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's meaningless. It's all meaningless. Without an answer. You do realize that what Jesus did on the cross was not just experience physical suffering or even physical death. No, it was much worse than that. You have Jesus, the very author of life, who Himself in those 3 years had been the very picture of meaning in life, alive, feasting. Remember the time He told His disciples, I have food that you know nothing about. He had a constant source of satisfaction because He was constantly in intimate relationship with the Father. And now, for the first time in all eternity, when He speaks, nothing happens. There's no answer. You know why? Because Jesus inserted himself into our meaningless existence. Life without God. Life under the sun. Because he took on the worst of Ecclesiastes so that we wouldn't have to. Why? Because his greatest happiness is in having you with him for all eternity. It was worth it for him. And when you see him doing that for you out of love because he delights in you, that changes your heart. That gives you a new reason to live. That makes your delight his delight. And when you fear God in this joyful way, letting him be at the center, it infuses everything you do with a source of meaning that nothing can take away. We're going to spend a moment in prayer. As Jeremy plays, I'm just going to give you a moment to bow your head and reflect silently. I want you to think about your life for a moment. What is it that you've been chasing after? What have you been investing in as your greatest treasure, your source of meaning, your delight? It may well be a good thing. But is it possible that you've turned it into an ultimate thing? If something is coming to mind and it's anything other than God, take a moment to silently confess that to him. To say, God, I have placed my hope and my delight in things other than you, and I am sorry. Forgive me. God is quick to forgive. Receive his forgiveness. And I would invite you to pray with me. God, we confess, every one of us, that we have at some point, perhaps even up to this very day, chased after all kinds of other things, as if they would satisfy our hearts, good things oftentimes, but we've placed them in a place in our lives that only belongs to you.